Okay, so this course has two kinds of names. One is Truth, Consequence and Paradox, designed to sucker you into attending, and one which I prefer, which is Philosophy of Logic, for its accuracy. So what we're going to be talking about, we're going to end up talking about things that are in some ways more superficially exciting. Okay, so we're going to start, though, by talking about logical consequence. And we're going to talk at what you'll feel to be great length about logical consequence and what the nature of logical consequence is. Having done that, having done the hard groundwork, we'll move on to talk about truth fairly generally, and particular views one might have about truth. Then we're going to move on to talk, connected with that, to talk about truth-related paradox, in particular the so-called liar paradox, okay, a kind of semantical paradox arising with respect to something like ordinary views about the way that truth works. So we'll talk about that. And then we're going to end by talking about some specific issues arising around vagueness. Right, so the idea that lots of the expressions we use and lots of the judgments we make carve things up in a kind of cloudy way, right? So that there's no absolutely sharp distinction between slightly orange things and slightly yellow and very yellow things, right? And there's no kind of sharp line between the yellow and the orange, and that gets us into trouble when we try and regiment our talk about colours logically. Similarly for a bunch of other cases, like baldness, height, and so forth. So we'll talk about that towards the end. So those, in a way, are the kind of bring your toys into class sessions where things get perhaps a bit more exciting. But the thing that's really important is the stuff about consequence. That's where you'll earn your right to talk about paradox. Okay, so for these two sessions, and actually for the next few sessions, we're going to be pursuing the following kinds of questions. So we're going to start by thinking at a fairly elementary level about what logic's about. So you've all done, or most of you have done, some introductory logic. Others of you will have at least come across some logic. We're going to be interested in what you were up to when you were doing logic in that way, what you were doing, what the purpose was, and what the point of studying logic in the particular ways you studied it might have been. Then we're going to start looking at issues surrounding a particular notion that figures in logic, the notion of logical consequence. I'll say more about that as we come to it. And hopefully, if there's time in these two sessions, we'll say a bit about proof and consequence and the relations between those notions. So very roughly, if you've done first year logic, the issues here are about what you call a natural deduction system. That would be a system of proof. Do you know about natural deduction systems? Okay, and consequence would be the thing where you do truth tables. And there are just questions about the connections between those two notions that we're going to be pursuing a bit. Okay? So what's logic about? Well, logic, as anything like a science, begins, I think, with Aristotle. And this is the sort of thing that Aristotle, a long time ago, used to say about the science of logic. He says, we must first state the subject of our inquiry and the faculty to which it belongs. Its subject is demonstration, and the faculty that carries it out, demonstrative science. Okay, so the idea there is that we're saying a bit more about logic by pointing out that what logic's about is demonstration, which I guess is close to some idea of proof, deciding matters, deciding the truth of particular claims. So that's Aristotle's idea. And then much later, a philosopher called Mark Sainsbury makes the following proposal about what logic is about, a proposal that might well be consistent with what Aristotle had to say. He says logic is about reasons and reasoning. It lays down standards. It says what reasons ought to move one. Okay, so it distinguishes, in effect, between good reasons for thinking something and bad reasons for thinking something. And it tells you how to go about spotting whether you form beliefs, say, on the basis of good reasons or bad reasons. Right? In effect, whether, you know, suppose I offer you some argument, and I claim that my argument demonstrates the truth of some proposition, One question for logic is to assess whether the reasons I've offered you, by way of my argument, really do demonstrate the conclusion, really do stand in this good reasons relation to the conclusion. Does this all sound kind of like the sort of thing you were up to in doing introductory logic, more or less? Good. Okay, so still at a very elementary level, thinking about what one's up to when one pursues these questions more systematically. Here are two kinds of transitions in thought, two ways one might move from thought to thought. So the first goes something like this. I think it's rained every day for the past 40 days, therefore it will rain today. Okay, that's something someone might think. The contrasting kind of transition would be number two, just think I'm tired, cars have tires, I didn't drive to work. That's something more like drifting in thought, like kind of daydreaming. So these are contrasting cases, and logic will try and say something about what sort of contrasts we might find between these sorts of cases. So pursuing Mark Sainsbury's idea, looks as though in one, in case it's rained for the last 40 days, so it will rain today, the transition is plausibly governed by some kind of normative rule, some rule that tells one how one should or shouldn't reason, how one should or shouldn't think about things. So roughly the rule would be, if something's happened a sufficient number of times in the past, one ought to have some expectation of it happening in the future, all else being equal. So if you've got someone who, I don't know, every day they enter the philosophy department and walk into a door frame, okay, every day they do it, 40 days in a row, and on the 41st day you might wonder whether they'll learn from the information they've been given by having walked into the door frame 40 times. If they don't, you might at least at that stage start wondering whether they're really living up to requirements on thinking rationally, requirements on treating information in their possession as reasons for going on in particular ways or not going on in particular ways. And similarly here, all else being equal, you might think that if it really has rained for the last 40 days, one natural expectation might be that it'll rain today. And someone who doesn't at least have an inclination to reason in that way, you might think has failed to meet standards of good reasoning. You might think. So someone might or might not make this kind of transition, but if they didn't, then unless they had reason not to make it, unless they had reason not to move from it's rained for the last 40 days so it'll rain tomorrow, for example, unless they had reason to think that the weather is especially unpredictable or what have you, or in the philosophy department case, reason to think that furniture, door frames might be moved around from day to day, we might think that their thinking is in some way at fault. Okay? It would be right to reason differently from the way they're reasoning, and the way their reasoning looks problematic. So that's one kind of transition. It's rained for the last 40 days, therefore it'll rain today. We just compared that with some kind of daydreaming, where there doesn't look to be any kind of question of good or bad. It's just something that's going on in someone's cognition, just some movements going on in their psychology. We've got that kind of transition. We can also compare it with another kind of transition that also looks subject to standards. So here we might compare the following argument. All men are mortal, Noah is a man, therefore Noah is mortal. Now, we saw, in effect, that with respect to three, it's rained for the last 40 days, therefore it will rain today. The premise doesn't guarantee the truth of the conclusion. Right? As Noah discovered, the truth of the claim that it's rained for the last 40 days doesn't guarantee the truth of the conclusion that it will rain today. Okay? So what's special about that kind of inference? It might well make it reasonable to believe it'll rain today, but it certainly doesn't guarantee it for you, right? By contrast, in case four, all men are mortal, Noah's a man, therefore Noah's mortal, the truth of the premises does seem to guarantee the conclusion. Right? So in Aristotle's terms, it supplies a demonstrative reason for the conclusion, right? Guarantees the conclusion. Couldn't be that those premises are true and the conclusion is false, right? By contrast with the earlier case. So put another way, when we characterise the normative force, kind of mode of assessment of the kind of reasoning involved in the three case, we thought that it had a kind of get-out clause. Okay? One should follow the inductive rule: if it's happened 40 times in the past, might well happen again, unless one has good reason to think that the transition's suspect in this particular case. Right? Reason to think that the weather is unpredictable or what have you. So with respect to this kind of inductive reasoning, some number of cases have happened, so the same thing's liable to happen in the future. There's always, it seems, or more or less always, this kind of get-out clause. Acquiring additional information could undermine the reasonableness of moving from the premise to the conclusion. By contrast, it's very plausible, at least, that reasoning like reasoning in 4, right, all men are mortal, Noah is a man, so Noah is mortal. In that case, we have no get-out clause. Whatever else one comes to believe, if one believes the two premises, then one ought to believe the conclusion. At least if one thinks about it, right? If one reflects on the things one believes. Slightly more carefully, one shouldn't both believe the premises and not believe the conclusion at the same time, right? Because you all know from thinking about bits of logic that sometimes, right, finding that some crazy conclusion follows from some premises indicates that the premises should be given up, even if you initially endorse them. So sometimes one might give up a premise in order to reject the conclusion. So it's not right, you believe some premises, you derive a conclusion, you're forced to buy that conclusion. The conclusion might be so repugnant that it leads you to give up some of the premises. But in order to be rational, according to this idea, you have to do one or the other. You can't hold on both to the premises and the conclusion. And no additional information will make it so that you should. Now, just say in passing, I'm not going to talk too much about this, that you might think there's a problem with that idea that no addition of information could lead you to worry about this transition, right? The premises, in that sense, guarantee the conclusion. Because you might think, you know, you believe P, you see that Q follows from P, but you also come to find out that not P or something, right? You come to find out that you believe contradictory things, something that contradicts P. You've got a contradiction there, and you might think that undermines or could potentially undermine the capacity of P to lead you to believe Q, okay? Well, in the kind of logic you've learned, insofar as you've done introductory logic, that won't help, right? Because if you come up with a contradiction in that logic, in the kind of classical logic you've learned, then everything follows, in effect, right? So in particular, Q follows. So if at any point in a derivation or a proof or what have you, in classical logic, you come up with P and not P, you win, right? Because absolutely everything would follow. So it can't be that you believe P and that Q follows from P, you acquire information that not P, and Q stops following, because Q would follow automatically from a contradiction. Obviously something else has gone wrong there, but not the demonstration of Q. That happens in classical logic, but there are other alternative logics, which some people unfairly call deviant logics, where that doesn't happen. Okay, so you could have a kind of logic that didn't like the idea that just because you run up against the contradiction somewhere, everything follows, right? It's a free-for-all. But I'm just noting that in passing. I'm not going to talk about it now. But that's one kind of worry you might have about the idea that where you have a demonstrative reason in the sense I've specified, nothing, no addition of information could undermine your right to move from the conclusions, the premises to the conclusion, or at least to be in a position where rationality demands that one either accept the conclusion or give up the premises. Okay, so I've idea from Aristotle still. Right, now we have an idea of demonstrative reasons. Right, demonstrative reasons are these reasons that guarantee the truth of the conclusion, or guarantee that you can't both accept the premises and reject the conclusion. And now Aristotle's idea is that logic is just about such demonstrative reasons. That's what its domain is. That's what its objective inquiry is. It seeks to systematically explore the nature of demonstrative reasons. So in particular, logic aims to characterize the relation that holds between claims or beliefs or whatever you think logic is governing, when some of those claims serve as demonstrative reasons for others. Okay? And that relation is the relation of consequence. Right? Where some premises guarantee the truth of a conclusion in this sense, the conclusion is a consequence of the premises. Okay? And in studying consequence, we're studying that relation. And that's what logic gets up to on this kind of approach. So, a little bit more specifically, logic has these kinds of sub-goals, right? Overarching aim, give an account of consequence. Here are some sub-goals. First, logic aims to say what the relation is, what the nature of the relation is between premises and conclusions, such that the premises provide demonstrative reasons for the conclusions in the required sense. Second, it aims to provide something by way of rules that will determine when the relation holds amongst arbitrary claims. Right, rules such that if one follows those rules and one attains an answer, that answer is bound to be correct. Right, it perfectly tracks what the nature of the relation is. So, for example, maybe something like rules of proof might do that. Right? And third, it aims to provide methods, more generally, that can be used in order to figure out when the relation holds. Again, proof might fall under that heading, but there might be other things that fall under that heading. Right? You might have kind of heuristic methods for figuring out whether a conclusion follows from some premises. Being heuristics, they wouldn't be guaranteed to give you the right answer, but they might work much of the time, and they might be very useful because they might be much easier to make use of than would be the full-blooded rules that will guarantee the right answer. Okay? And logic might want to talk about all of those things. Very often when one does a logic course, one goes beyond simply learning about the nature of consequence and about the rules governing the relation of consequence. One also learns tricks, right? How to take shortcuts in order to figure out whether or not a conclusion follows from some premises. So the kind of difference I have in mind here is a bit like the difference between these two ways of figuring out how many people there are in this room. Right? So five would be more like a kind of rule. It says the number of people in this room is determined by a 1-1 correlation between people in the room and natural numbers starting with 1. Right? So you array all the natural numbers starting with 1, and then you just pair those numbers up with individual people in the room. And that's a way of determining how many people are in the room. Another way of going is more like a method, to figure out the number of people in the room by locking the door and then counting them. Right? Now, if you do this right, then you're guaranteed to get the right answer. But this is more like a method because something might go wrong. You might lock the door too slowly. Right? You might miscount or whatever. So this is the way to act, if you want to figure out quickly how many people in the room, do a quick head count with the door locked. But this is the kind of rule that governs selection of the correct answer. Something like that. So these are the kinds of things that logic might get up to, very generally speaking. We're not going to be doing very much logic here. We're going to be thinking about logic. So we're going to be slightly less concerned about things like rules and methods, except in the general case, where we want to reflect on what it comes to have those kinds of rules or methods. So, so far we've said that logic's about demonstrative reasons. Logic wants to tell us what it is for there to be demonstrative reasons between premises and conclusions. Perhaps it wants to go beyond that by specifying rules and methods for tracing out that relation between premises and conclusion. But I think we need to say a bit more to properly specify the subject matter of logic. So logic doesn't just aim to do all that, it aims to do all that in a particular way. And this is part of why Aristotle thinks of logic as a science, right, as opposed to a kind of fairy tale or some other kind of way of understanding the world. So logic aims to be systematic and it aims to be general. So the thing to focus on here in particular, I mean there are other things one could think about, but focus on the distinction between the following two transitions. This is what's going to be most important for our purposes. All men are mortal, Noah's a man, therefore Noah's mortal. That's one kind of transition. And we can see that in that case it looks as though the premises guarantee the conclusion. Here, compare with A, Noah's mortal, therefore Noah will not live forever. Okay, again, premise seems to guarantee the conclusion. What we're going to be looking at is what seems to be at least plausible, which is that there are ways of giving a systematic and general account of what's going on in 7 that aren't applicable to what's going on in 8. Okay, I'll say something more about that now. So focus on 7, all men are mortal, Noah's a man, therefore Noah's mortal. Figuring out that the transition here involves demonstrative reason or consequence doesn't seem really to depend on knowing anything about men, mortality, Noah, and so forth. Okay? The fact that there's a relation of consequence here doesn't depend, it seems, on specific facts about men, about Noah, or about mortality. It seems to be more general than that. I'll say more about this in a moment, but at least to a first approximation, it seems to have something to do with the structure or form of the argument. Any argument with the same kind of structure or form as this argument would be equally good or equally bad. Okay? By contrast, we look at Noah's mortal, therefore Noah will not live forever. Figuring out the consequence relation here does seem to depend on knowing something about mortality and living forever. Right, in particular, that mortal beings don't live forever, at least by nature, right? Unless some super being intervenes and forces them to. Okay? So although it's very natural to think there's a genuine relation of consequence of some sort here, it looks like in this case, the obtaining of that relation of consequence depends on specific features of the subject matter involved here. The fact that we're talking about mortality, the fact that we're talking about not living forever, and the fact that being mortal seems to require not living forever, something like that. Okay. And that at least suggests that one won't get a very general account of cases like this. Right? There might be other cases that are a bit like this, but that depend on very different kinds of bits of information. Right, this is a vixen, therefore this is female, for example. Right, looks a bit similar to Noah's mortal, therefore Noah will live forever. It looks like being a vixen provides a demonstrative guarantee for being female, because vixens are just female foxes. But seeing that seems to depend on that specific knowledge about vixens and about being female. Okay? So if you were trying to account for all of these cases, it looks like you'd have lots of fairly specific things to say about each of the individual cases. By contrast, in the earlier case, at least in principle, it looks as though you could perhaps say something more general. And that makes a difference to how at least some, perhaps many logicians think about their subject matter, because they want to be able to say very general, systematic things, and they'd rather not just provide a dictionary-like list of connections between things like being a vixen and being female. being mortal and not living forever. So, although both of those cases are naturally thought of as involving a relation of consequence, many theorists want to restrict the domain of logic to cases like 7, to cases like all men are mortal, Noah's a man, therefore Noah's mortal. And they want to call this special subclass of consequence relations, the ones about which it's possible to say something very general, logical consequence relations, a kind of stipulation based on these consequence relations being the proper subject matter of logic. As we'll see, I think, in the seminars, not everyone agrees, right? So this is one of the targets of Stephen Reed's paper, Formal and Material Consequence. So he wants to argue that it's an error for logicians and philosophers of logic to focus on this kind of general systematic case as opposed to the more specific cases involving things like vixenhood and mortality. And as we go through, we'll see some reasons for worrying that have to do with some potential issues about the clarity of this distinction between the cases about which it's possible to say something very general and the cases about which it seems not to be. So why do logicians think it's a good idea to focus in this way? Well, I've said that they want to give an account that's general and systematic, but we can perhaps say a bit more about what their motivations are here. So one kind of idea you can call kind of idea of tractability. So theorists think that one can provide a clear and systematic account of logical consequence, but not of consequence more generally. One just can't do it, right? A theory of consequence in general would be a theory of everything. Vixens, humans, mortality, and so forth, right? It'd be like a big encyclopedia of specific bits of information, presumably endless. By contrast, logicians think that we at least have a hope of providing a genuine theory, a genuinely systematic account that's usable with respect to the more general, formal-like connections of consequence involved in the kind of logic that you've looked at. And it seems right that over the centuries, logicians have made significant progress, right, by focusing in that way. So we might think that that's grounds in favour of this idea. No one's provided a general account of the other kinds of cases. It's not clear what that would even amount to. But we at least have an inkling about how to go about constructing theories of the more general-looking case. And that's precisely the kind of theory that you learn about in introductory and more advanced cases of logic. So you've got tractability. You've also got generality. So theorists think that their aim in general should, and this is theorists in general actually, not just logicians, should be to supply the most general possible account of their subject matter, in this case, of consequence. And in order to do that, they're prepared to confine their attention to logical consequence. They want to provide an account that covers the largest possible range of cases, right? And then there's going to be no general account that does that and also covers the vixen case, the mortality case, and all the others, right? So if one wants to cover as many cases as possible all at once, as one typically does in theorising, then their idea is the best way of doing that is to focus one's attention on the formal, the more formal-looking cases. A third kind of reason that stands in favour of their approach is that they think we have some kind of pre-theoretical conception, at least some people think this, have some kind of pre-theoretical conception of a genuinely logical guarantee. Right, so the thought here is that there's such a thing as purely logical consequence as opposed to consequence more generally. And we have a kind of pre-theoretical, pre-philosophical sensitivity to that. Right? We can already start feeling the difference between these cases. It would be perfectly natural simply to decide to focus one's theoretical attention on one rather than another. not to denigrate consequence more generally, needn't even be to deny that a theory of consequence more generally could be given. But given that we can distinguish between these subject matters, we might well think that logic should focus on one subclass, and there could be one or more other kinds of disciplines that focus on the others. It's fairly natural. Here's a kind of analogy. To someone, and people often like to advertise their wares in this way these days, might try and give a theory of everything. So here's my theory of everything. Typically that's a theory of physics, so not everything. But get the picture, that someone might think it was a good idea to try and give a theory about everything. Perhaps you think that metaphysicians sometimes get up to this sort of thing. You might think, right, just by minimal reflection on this, that that's a really silly thing to attempt, right, theory of absolutely everything. I mean, perhaps you might think that's a plausible end for inquiry in general, right, having a theory of everything. But it would be weird to set out one morning with the idea that one might, you know, be successful, one might over the next 10 years provide a theory of absolutely everything. Someone else might think it's more sensible to confine their attention to specific subclasses of those things. For example, physical particles. Perhaps more typically, right, sets of at most two physical particles in closed systems. It's the kind of thing that physicists often focus on. And the idea of focusing in that way might be precisely the guided by the kinds of ideas we just characterised with respect to logic. Right? So the aim might be to achieve tractability. Perhaps physical particles, at least in simple closed systems, are easier to theorise about than people, or tables and chairs, or cats. Right? So perhaps there's a gain in tractability by focusing one's attention on this subcase. Generality. The theory of physical particles doesn't depend, in general, on special features distinguishing things like mercury or wood. It might enable you to account for those differences. It doesn't start out by having to deal with those kinds of differences. Right? So you might think you can provide a theory of particles that covers all particles all at once. Right? Whereas if you try and give a theory of everything, it might start looking as though you have to give one theory about mercury and one theory about wood. Otherwise, you haven't captured everything. And third, you might have a pre-theoretical conception of physical particles, more or less pre-theoretical conception of physical particles. You might have an idea of the distinction between those and tables and chairs, bits of wood, lumps of mercury. Okay? You might use that, you might just decide, I want to focus on this, for whatever reason, I want to focus on the particles. And that might guide you in making a decision about investigation, given that you don't think it's a good idea to try and investigate everything all at once. And probably more plausibly, you might have a pre-theoretical conception of living beings, right? That's typically the kind of thing that kicks off biological inquiry. Have the idea that there are some obviously living things, some obviously non-living things, at least prima facie, and then perhaps a range of intermediate cases. You just decide that you can't theorise about all that at once, so you focus on the living things. You do biology. Right? And then you might focus in more. You might think I have a pre-theoretical conception of a distinction between plants and animals. Again, subject to a range of intermediate cases. You might decide to focus on the plants rather than the animals. Again, because you think that doing so will give you more likelihood of coming up with a reasonable theory. There'll be some loss with respect to certain kinds of generality, right? You won't thereby have a total theory of biology because you've just focused on the plants, but you might be able to make significant progress in that subdomain, whereas you might have been completely stymied had you attempted to give an account of biology in general. So, here are some questions that arise at this point. Okay, so we've got the idea, we've got at least a crude idea about what consequence is, and we've got a slightly more developed but still crude idea of what logical consequence is, where logical consequence looks to be a kind of subclass of cases of consequence. Here are some questions that one can pursue and that will be pursued about these cases. The first question one might pursue, and this will be in the background for us, what is the nature of the consequence relation? Is there anything to be said at that general level about what it is for there to be these kinds of guarantees between premises and conclusions? Might be something general to be said about that, there might not. Second question is, what is the logical consequence relation? And I've already suggested that we might well think that the logical consequence relation is a kind of subcase of consequence more generally. So we might want to give an account of the logical consequence relation by starting with a more general account of consequence and then focusing in on this subcase. So adding conditions, for example, to the general account of consequence in order to say something specifically about logical consequence. That's sometimes how it goes. As we'll see, however, it's at least arguable that some approaches to logical consequence, indeed some of the most prominent approaches to logical consequence, don't quite take that route. Rather, there's a way in which they seem to treat logical consequence as almost entirely different from consequence more generally, or rather from consequence in cases like the case where being a vixen has as a consequence being female. Okay, but we'll get to that as we go through. So more specifically, right, because, you know, we're philosophers, so we don't have a hope in hell of answering these questions in any set of lectures or any lifetime, we're going to be looking at some specific accounts that have been offered. So I want to know what kinds of theoretical accounts have been offered of the nature, extent, and methods for figuring out the extent of this relation of consequence. What have people said? Right? You already know some partial answers to that by virtue of doing introductory logic. And then what we're going to do, what we're going to want to do, is to see how well those theoretical accounts that have been offered line up with pre-theoretical answers we might be inclined to give, right? Including the more or less pre-theoretical answers we've come up with so far in terms of guarantees, demonstrations, the idea that one can rely on a connection between premises and conclusions. There's some kind of norm governing good thinking that it ought to trace these connections of consequence and avoid connections that aren't connections of consequence, perhaps. And that there's something irrational or problematic about reasoning or thinking in a way that's out of accord with relations of consequence, in particular, contrary to those relations of consequence. Okay? So we're going to want to look at the theoretical accounts that have been offered, and then compare those with what we hoped we'd get out of an account of consequence. So that's the kind of thing we're going to be up to. Say a little bit more about some of that. So, back to Aristotle. Now focus on these particular cases of transitions that we might want to think about from a logical perspective. Where you've got some premises and the allegation that those premises have, as a consequence, some conclusion. So we're talking about something like deduction. Right, deductive or demonstrative inference. These mean more or less the same thing. So Aristotle says the following. A deduction is speech in which certain things having been supposed, something different from those supposed results of necessity because of their being so, right? Because of the supposition. Okay. So the idea is that is that that's what logic's about. Logic's about deduction characterised in that way. Deduction is speech in which some number of things are supposed, your premises, I guess, in effect, or your assumptions, and something other than those premises or assumptions results as a matter of necessity, right? Which I take as at least labelling the idea of a guarantee. The idea that premises guarantee the conclusion. Now, we might want to depart from precisely what Aristotle says here for a number of reasons. So one is that Aristotle seems to think here of deduction as involving speech, or at least writing. We might think it also involves bits of thinking, thoughts, perhaps the things we think, what philosophers sometimes call propositions, right? The thing you think when you think that it's Friday today. That would be the proposition that it's Friday today. We might think that logic is about those, at least as much as it's about bits of speech or bits of writing. Second, Aristotle says that what results, right, the conclusion of this deduction, must be different from what's supposed, right, the premises. But we might think, and you ought to have been brought up to think, that A, therefore A, is impeccable from a logical perspective. It's not as if A doesn't guarantee the truth of A, right? So you might think that we can drop the restriction that the conclusion of our deduction must be different from the premises of the assumption, supposition. Okay? It's at least how we ordinarily do this in classical logic, right? You've learnt first year logic, you'll have learned, I hope fairly early on, that if anything follows from A, it's A. Moreover, third, Aristotle appears to some commentators at least, right, this isn't entirely uncontroversial, appears to some commentators to require things to have been supposed. So deductions with more than one premise, right, typically two premises, but more than one premise. Again, we might think that's a restriction too far. Again, A, therefore A, we might think is, you know, it's dull, it's not very helpful, but it's logically impeccable. It only has one premise. We might even want to allow that certain kinds of deductions are possible from no premises. Okay? Often they will involve something by way of supposition or assumption, but we might want to allow that. Right? We might want to allow that you can deduce that either A or not A from no premises at all. Fourth, Aristotle appears to require some kind of explanatory connection of some sort between premises and conclusion. He talks about the conclusion being true because, or being necessary because of the premises, right? As if the premises have to explain, the truth of the premises have to explain why the conclusion holds. And that might be taken to rule out various kinds of classically impeccable deductions, for example, of anything from a contradiction, right? If it's raining and not raining, then the moon is made of cheese. Okay? That's a classically impeccable derivation. Okay? We might think that the moon's being made of green cheese has nothing at all to do with it's raining or not raining, right? Either or both. So we might think that Aristotle's restriction here, that there ought to be some kind of explanatory connection between premises and conclusion, would be at least in conflict with the kind of classical logic we've been looking at. We might not, right? Again, there are a class of deviant logicians, in particular so-called relevance logicians, who think that in order for you to have a logically good argument, so a genuine case of consequence, your premises should be, in some to be specified sense, relevant to the conclusions. It's not quite the same demand for explanatoriness that Aristotle goes for. It's just to point out that although classical logic, the kind you learn in the first year, doesn't meet anything like this requirement, we might think it's a reasonable requirement, right? There's room for dispute about whether or not we should adhere to this requirement. But we typically don't. Fifth, perhaps most importantly, as we'll see, it's not quite clear what Aristotle means by necessity as governing the relation between premises and conclusion, and what he takes that necessitation relation to govern. Now, he might mean what we typically would mean nowadays as analytic philosophers, which is something like true in every possible way for things to be, or every possible world, right? When I say something's necessary, given my training, that's typically because I think it's true in every possible world. So if I think that some premises necessitate a conclusion, I think something like this, there's no possible world where the premises are true and the conclusion's false. There's no way the world could possibly be where the premises are true and the conclusion's false. And it could be, right, that that's what Aristotle means. But there are other alternative ways of understanding this kind of talk about necessity. Right, so one thing he might mean instead is that the relation holds of everything there actually is. Right? Not of every possible thing and not of every possible way for things to be, but of everything in the actual world, everything around here. Perhaps also at every time. Right? So sometimes people use necessity to talk about things that always happen. They needn't happen, right? But they always do happen. So perhaps Aristotle's talking about that. Perhaps indeed, although it's difficult to get clear about this because of Aristotle's focus on speech, he might mean something more kind of epistemological, more to do with rationality and reasonable thinking, to do with the conditions under which one can't know one thing without knowing another. So you might think something's necessary because if you think the one thing, you must think the other thing. If you think the premises, you must think the conclusion, at least if you're living up to standards of rationality. So it's not entirely clear what Aristotle takes necessity to be doing here, how he thinks it works. Connected, you might wonder what Aristotle means results of necessity to govern, what he's talking about there. He might be talking about truths, or putative truths, so propositions, right? He might be talking about the kinds of things that bear truth, the kinds of things that are true or false. Might be saying that if we assume the truth of these things, these propositions, that will guarantee and moreover explain the truth of these other propositions. Alternatively, he might be thinking about beliefs, and he might be thinking about new claims, right? So instead of it being that the truth, this is a vixen guarantees the truth that this is a fox, might be talking about some connection between beliefs, such that if one believes that this is a vixen, one must believe that this is a fox. That's what the necessity relation governs. Similarly, he might be saying something like that, but for claims rather than for beliefs. He might be saying, if you claim that, then you must, for some reason, also claim this. Otherwise, something would have gone wrong. So on that latter view, we might understand Aristotle to be suggesting that deduction involves our being forced or normatively required, in Mark Sainsbury's sense, to think or claim things based on what we already think, the premises or assumptions we're making. Like when you're in an argument with someone, and you say, but look, you believe that P. If you believe that, you must also believe that Q. Right? Perhaps we don't mean that it's a fact, a necessity about human psychology, that you must already believe that, but rather that there's a kind of normative demand on you. Right, that if you already believe this, there'd be something wrong with you if you fail to believe this other thing. Okay, something would have gone wrong with your reason or your rationality. So the options here indicate some of the major views, in fact, that have been taken about the nature of consequence and about logical consequence. Right, with respect to each of those questions, taking different views will give you a different kind of account of consequence and or a different account of logical consequence. So here are three kinds of views that we're going to be talking about as we proceed. So first view says that premises have as a logical consequence some conclusion, just in case modal account, it's not possible, right, can't be in any possible world, that the premises are true and the conclusion's false. the kind of modal accounts of consequence. Right? It's impossible for you to get a vixen that isn't female. It's just impossible. And similarly for the other cases. There's no possible way for the world to be, no possible world more generally, in which you've got a vixen, all right, but it's not female. That would be fitting the modal account. A different kind of account, which might end up having the same kinds of results, is what we can call the a priori account. Here the idea is something like this, that conclusion is a consequence of some premises if it can be established by armchair reflection or the like, that it's not the case that the premises are true and the conclusion is false. Right? You don't have to go out and check, you can just reflect in your study and figure this out. And if you can do that, then you have a genuine case of consequence. And the third kind of account is different again, and this is the topic neutrality account. This says something like the following, that it's determined by the most general features of any subject matter at all, that it's not the case that the premises are true and the conclusion is false. Okay? Again, this view might end up telling you the same things about where you've got cases of consequence or not, but it differs in the reason it gives for why those cases count as cases of logical consequence or not. So those are three kinds of accounts that we'll be pursuing as we progress. But we're going to pause.